It's On Health. I'm Alice Nobre. If you've ever had hives, psoriasis, or flare-ups of acne, you know that skin disorders can take quite a toll. We'll get to that. Also, the relationship between the food industry and the healthcare industry. A discussion with Michael Pollan, the author of In Defense of Food. But first, a quick update on the healthcare overhaul debate. I'm joined here in the studio by my colleagues Julie Rovner. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Allison.
And Joe Neal. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Allison.
They have been watching every move that the Obama administration and Congress have been making as the debate unfolds. Julie, let's start with the effect that President Obama's full court press talking healthcare overhaul has had. There was the address to Congress last week, a speech in Minnesota over the weekend. Is any of this changing the momentum in Congress or altering public opinion?
Well, even before the president's speech, we saw a little bit of an impact. Senator Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, who's been negotiating, it feels like, for months. It actually has been for months with this gang of six, three Democrats and three Republicans behind closed doors, came out the day before the president's speech and said, enough already. If he doesn't get a deal with these five other members, he's going to go ahead and put his plan out on the table this week. Next week, he's going to go ahead and have a committee vote. And now it looks like the week after that, there could be a bill on the Senate floor. So then just the president saying he was going to have a speech had some impact on that part of the debate. And indeed, I think we did see some of the quickie polls and some polls after that, that the president's speech did move some numbers. Now, whenever a president makes a speech like this, there is some short-term movement. Whether that has long-term impact, we won't know for the long term.
But when it comes to these polls and what the public is saying, at least in terms of what we know from these surveys, are people saying that they understand the bill any better? Did the support for it go up or down since last week?
Actually, from the polls I've looked at, one of the good things, I think, as far as the administration is concerned, is that people do say they understand more of what it is that the president wants. There was a huge comprehension gap, if you will. I heard one pollster say that in one of his polls, two-thirds of people said they had no idea what this debate was about. I think that number has gone down a lot. Support seems to have gone up. It's still pretty tight. It's 50-50. This is to be expected, I think, from where we are in this debate. You know, always at the beginning when people say, oh, do you want to fix the healthcare system? You get big majorities that say, of course.
Sure, everybody can see
broken.
Something that's wrong with the system.
Right. As soon as you start getting to details, people pull back and say, oh, this might cost me money. So support plummets. I mean, that's natural in these big debates. You're talking about a sixth of the economy, billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in this case. So now, you know, the polls are kind of, we're at this 50-50 moment. And of course, Congress is scared because they went home in August. People yelled at them. We saw this big demonstration here in Washington on Saturday. All these people, they said there might be 2 million. It wasn't that much. It was more like tens of thousands, but lots of angry people.
So you're the official estimator?
Well, that was what we saw. Those were the numbers that I saw.
Tens of thousands is a lot.
It was a big demonstration. I will not.
These Tea Party folks who say, "Look, this is all just too much government spending."
That's right. That's what they were saying. Let us stipulate, there were a lot of angry people here on the lawn of the Capitol on Saturday.
Let me turn to you, Joe. The so-called public plan seems to be tripping up a lot of folks who are in this camp, who were perhaps here in D.C., people who are upset about too much government. What are we learning about doctors' view on this? Do doctors think there should be a public plan in this healthcare reform?
Well, there's a new poll that came out on Monday showing that almost 73% of doctors support a public option. And you break that down, about 10% support a single-payer plan. Like in Canada or
so
in the UK.
So much more support.
The other 62.7, I forget the exact number, support a mix of public and private options, similar to what's been proposed by President Obama and congressional Democrats.
Now, would they support it for the same reason that many in the public would support it, just a sense that if there were something like Medicare but for more folks, that more people would be getting insurance and it's actually better for the doctors?
Well, the poll also looked at doctor attitudes toward Medicare, our biggest single-payer program. We have three single-payer programs in our country, Medicare for the elderly and disabled, Medicaid for the poor. And the Veterans Administration, and I guess the Indian Health Service, too, I have to throw that one in, where the government is the primary payer. Doctors in this survey were not as dissatisfied with Medicare as is commonly believed. They were not as upset with Medicare's paperwork. They complain more about private insurers' paperwork. And I think over time, what we've heard in our reporting over the years is that doctors have to deal with so many different insurance companies, so many different rules and regulations, that they would love it if it were greatly simplified and a government option, a public insurance plan with just one set of forms, one set of rules, is something that they would very much like.
Sure, a streamlined approach.
Yeah.
You know, what I hear from a lot of doctors is that Medicare may pay slightly less than a lot of private insurers, but they pay it much more reliably. And I think a lot of doctors would trade that reliability of payment for the slightly higher payment, but to have to jump through so many more hoops with private insurers. In fact, I hear that a lot from doctors. It's like, you know, maybe it would just be easier to take the lower cost, but they could, you know, maybe not have as many clerks and people to push the paperwork, mm-hmm. and they would be glad to trade that off. And in the end, they might actually end up with more take-home pay because they wouldn't have to have so many employees to do some of that paperwork.
Well, this survey also showed that, and I should stop and say that it was 2,100 doctors. It was in the New England Journal.
Is 2,100 doctors representative?
That's huge. I mean, most surveys, you only get about 1,000. This was a mail-in survey. It was a very short survey. It took about 4 minutes to complete. It
had a broad section of internists and specialists.
Broad selection across. It's very representative. We had other poll experts look at the methodology, and they were convinced that it was quite solid. One thing that it showed in terms of Medicare and payments that Julie was just talking about is that doctors are pretty dissatisfied with the lower level of payments that Medicare gives. And they also said that Medicare didn't pay quite as fast as private insurers. But when you look at it overall, they are more reliable payers because they don't bounce as many claims. They don't reject as many claims. They don't create so many pre-approval processes that most insurers force doctors to do.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Joe Neal, Julie Rovner.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
And now, the latest in treating and understanding skin diseases. We'll take a look at triggers that might cause flare-ups, but first, psoriasis. Not only is this skin disease painful, it can be embarrassing, causing people to hide their skin and even isolate themselves. Here's my colleague, Patty Namond.
A fashion show in New York City. Cindy McGowan walks the catwalk. Like the other models, McGowan wears a custom-designed outfit of spaghetti strap dress showing off her arms, which are covered with psoriasis, thick, dry, red patches of skin.
I have it on both my elbows, both my knees, both my ankles. I have large patches up the back of my triceps, some patches that go down to my wrist and on all of my knuckles. And I also have a different pattern. They kind of call it the raindrop pattern, where it just sprinkles little dots on different parts of your body.
All the models, including one man, have severe cases of plaque psoriasis, the most common form of the disease. It's not contagious, although uneducated strangers often think it is. At its most severe, it can be very painful and itchy. It comes and goes. No one knows exactly why outbreaks occur. Psoriasis is a chronic, lifelong disease.
Let's welcome Cynthia, who's wearing it.
McGowan says events like this, co-sponsored by drug manufacturers and the National Psoriasis Foundation, among others, aim to demystify the disease so strangers don't gawk. For Isabel Estevez, this kind of support was literally life-saving, she says. Estevez was diagnosed at 5 years old. At 9, she had an experience that shaped her life. She was at a water park.
My skin was pretty bad, broken out, and a young girl approximately my age with her mother saw my skin and immediately freaked out and tugged on her mother. Oh, my God, what's wrong with that girl? And the mother looked at me shocked, equally in terror, pulled her daughter away from me, you know, just said, stay away. And it was at that point that I never went back to a water park or... that's when I really began hiding my skin from the world, because just the look on their faces really just sent me into shame.
So Estevez wore pants and long sleeves, no matter how hot. She never wore her hair up. She wore jackets all the time. Then she did an internet search on psoriasis and found the National Psoriasis Foundation, which happened to be having a conference in Chicago near her home.
I genuinely thought I was going to show up to this conference and I would be the only one there. And imagine my eyes when I walked in and there was a room full of 500 people, all with psoriasis, all who knew what I was going through. I saw people exposing their skin and not afraid, and it in turn gave me the inspiration to do the same.
Support from other patients, says Estevez, have helped bring her out of hiding.
You know what? I wear whatever I want. I mean, if it's cold, I wear long sleeves. If it's hot, I'll wear sleeveless. I'll wear shorts. If someone wants to go to the beach, okay, what time should I be there? I'll bring my sunscreen.
There is no cure for psoriasis, and treatments often fail or wear off over time. Some people use anti-itch creams, which often contain cortisone or other steroids. There are ointments that contain tar, creams that reduce scaling, dandruff shampoos, moisturizers, vitamin D or A. Oatmeal baths can soothe, and ultraviolet light treatments can help. For severe psoriasis, there are medicines to suppress the body's immune response because psoriasis is thought to be an autoimmune disease where the body's immune system turns on itself. But the most promising treatments, say dermatologists like Mark Lebwohl from Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, are drugs called biologics, which came on the market about 5 years ago.
Most of the biologics available are forms of antibodies that are directed against specific parts of the immune system.
Because the drugs suppress the immune system, patients may be more vulnerable to certain infections and even malignancies. Lebwohl says there's a dramatic new biologic awaiting federal approval.
For the first time, we actually have an injection where you get 4 shots a year, and it clears the majority of patients. With just 4 shots a year, and that is a true breakthrough.
About 3/4 of patients with severe psoriasis saw dramatic improvement. For half of the patients, the psoriasis cleared completely.
It turns out that emotions, too, can influence many skin disorders. A stressful event can trigger a flare-up of psoriasis, acne, hives, or eczema. Kristen Palsisco, who suffers from psoriasis, says for her, the worst part about the disease is the sense that you're wearing your emotions on your skin.
So you feel like everybody can see how you're feeling, and oh my gosh, how embarrassing, because this is not an attractive way to present, you know, what's going on the inside. So you just sort of feel exposed, or unzipped is how I used to call it.
Over the years, lots of patients have made the connection between stress and psoriasis. For Palsisco, it happened back in college. She'd had a mild case, on and off, for several years. But when her father died, she says her grief and depression seemed to make the condition much worse. Throughout her early 20s, she noticed the same pattern. The severity of her symptoms seemed to track her state of mind.
And if I were to start exercising, eating well, feeling better about myself in general, I would notice a difference within 2 weeks.
Researchers are learning a lot about the mind-body connections in skin disease, and doctors are beginning to treat the two in tandem in cases where there's a clear connection with anxiety or depression. Joseph Locala is a psychiatrist at the University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland. He sees patients at the Murdoch Family Center for Psoriasis.
If you think of the skin, it's a barrier of defense for the body, and it's our main way of communicating with the outside world.
If we're embarrassed, we blush. If we're mad, we flush. And nervous, sweat. These are some of the emotional signals everyone can see, but there's a lot more going on. Locala explains that in the skin, all the systems of the body, including the nervous system and immune system, are talking to each other.
There's so many nerve endings that terminate in the skin, and there's such a strong influence of the hormones and the immune system in the skin in order to protect the body. So all these systems have to be functioning at a high level in the skin.
But when we get really stressed out, Locala says our bodies activate chemicals called cytokines. They're always there in our bodies, including in our skin.
And there are some that are actually used to decrease inflammation and decrease reactions in the skin, and others that would actually increase inflammation called pro-inflammatory cytokines.
When stress initiates a cascade of cytokines, researchers suspect it can help set off a flare-up. Of course, not everyone develops psoriasis or hives or outbreaks of acne. There are genes and hormones that make some of us more vulnerable. As for patient Kristen Talsisco, she now meditates and walks regularly. She also uses UV light therapy and a topical cream to treat the few small patches of scaly skin that linger.
I learned a lot of tools about, managing stress, managing my emotions, and the connection between my health and those things.
In treating skin disorders, the goal should be to treat the whole patient, says psychiatrist Joe Locala. He says psoriasis sufferers tend to have higher rates of depression and anxiety, but many times they don't seek help beyond the skin issue. That's why he works as part of a team with dermatologists and psychologists.
Because the dermatologist can say, this is a doctor who works with us in our clinic, we'd like you to see him, that there's less of a stigma attached to that and they're more willing to come to see me.
And he says in his experience, the collaboration often opens the door to helpful treatments. In a recent opinion piece in the New York Times, journalist Michael Pollan wrote, "The American way of eating has become the elephant in the room in the debate over healthcare." NPR's Guy Raz spoke with him recently on Weekend All Things Considered.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now says most healthcare spending in America goes to treat preventable diseases, many of them linked to diet. And according to Pollan, one of the leading products of the American food industry has become patients for the American healthcare industry. Michael Pollan, how does the food industry create business for the healthcare industry?
Well, as you suggest in your intro, we've got an epidemic of chronic disease linked to diet. It represents a significant part of the money we're spending on health care. We're talking about type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, many types of cancer. And right now, the one that is really threatening to bankrupt the healthcare system is type 2 diabetes, which the CDC estimates that 1 in 3 Americans born after the year 2000 may well get. And that's really expensive to treat. The government's about to put itself on the hook to pay a lot of these costs, and they could well swamp the new healthcare system.
Michael Pollan, President Obama was in Minnesota today to stump for his healthcare reform plan. Minnesota, of course, is a big agribusiness state. It's one of the country's largest corn producers. You target high fructose corn syrup in particular, and you talk about how the government both subsidizes this product and the treatment of type 2 diabetes caused in part by the consumption of this product.
Yeah, that's the big contradiction of our system. I mean, we have a set of agricultural subsidies that are designed in such a way that they encourage farmers to overproduce things like corn, and that big corn crop gets turned into soda in the form of high fructose corn syrup and other sweetened beverages. We know that adolescents are getting about 15% of their calories from these drinks. One of the reasons that soda is so popular is it's cheap. And the reason for that is that the high fructose corn syrup is so cheap. And then we're also paying for the cost, the damage that all that cheap sugar is doing to our health.
You write that the healthcare industry actually gets more profit from, for example, amputating a diabetic's leg rather than preventing that person from getting diabetes in the first place. How is that?
Well, it's one of the perverse incentives we have. You know, much money is made in treatments and very little money is made in prevention. When you're doing prevention, you're addressing everybody. You know, you're counseling a lot of people who are never going to get diabetes. So one of the things that happens, I think, under the rules changes that are being proposed, and even the weakest of the healthcare bills on offer right now, would change those incentives, I think, in a very positive way, at least on part of the health insurers. They would be on the hook. In a way, they're not now. They will have a direct financial interest in preventing every new case of type 2 diabetes or obesity or heart disease.
Large agribusinesses do make food cheaper. There's no question about that. How do you make your case, particularly when we're in the middle of an economic crisis?
You know, nobody likes food to get more expensive, and everybody likes cheap food. But it's important to understand the real cost of cheap food. You pay one way or another. The food may be cheap to the consumer, but the cost to your health and the cost to the system, when you add that together, it's not so cheap.
What do you propose to do for people who don't have easy access to fresh produce, to high-quality food?
Sure. Well, there are many different levers we can pull. I mean, we can look at food assistance. What if all those food stamps recipients also got a $20 or $30 monthly coupon that allowed them to buy fresh produce or go to the farmer's market? That would suddenly draw farmers markets into the inner cities to reap all that cash.
What if healthcare is overhauled and it doesn't change the American diet in any way?
We'll go broke. If we don't get a handle on these healthcare costs, the new system or the old system will go broke. And that's why I think that really food is the elephant in the room when we're talking about healthcare.
You know, it's always interesting to understand why people aren't eating the way they say they want to eat or the way they know they should be eating. And studies suggest that it's lots of reasons why. I mean, one is just stress. Who hasn't, you know, gone to bed with a little bucket of ice cream on a night when they didn't feel so good instead of making a healthy dinner? There's also lots of structural reasons. Sometimes it's hard to get access to good food. And sometimes people realize that it just takes a lot of preparation and planning to get good, healthy meals on the table. I'm really curious about all this and going to be taking a much closer look at it in the next few months. Well, that's all for this week's On Health. If you'd like to write to us, please do so at NPR Health, one word, at npr.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Aubrey.